From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, as our nation gets collectively heavier, why are we shunning political candidates who are heavy?
Both obese and overweight candidates tend to be greatly underrepresented.
Who gets to decide if a Canadian mining company can buy 10,000 acres in the Upper Peninsula?
It's somewhat interesting that something this significant that will absolutely transform life for generations in the UP more or less comes down to one guy.
Can delivering beer, wine, and liquor to a house help keep drinking drivers off the roads? A new company is betting yes.
No hassle. Everything charged straight to your credit card. You don't have to get up off your couch and leave.
And we discover a form of street dance that started in the 70s, the Detroit Jit. Those stories and more on Stateside. The Michigan Department of Natural Resources is considering selling 10,000 acres of its state-managed forest land to a Canadian limestone mining company. Who ultimately gets to decide if that company can buy the land and set up a limestone mine in the Upper Peninsula? I'm Cynthia Canty. On today's Stateside, we look at what this proposed limestone mining operation could mean for UP residents. Then a rare 80-year-old American agave plant at the Mathai Botanical Gardens in Ann Arbor is just about ready to bloom. Bloom for its first and its only time. That story later this hour. But first, Michigan has taken its initial step toward sending aid money to Detroit. The newly formed House Committee on Detroit's Recovery and Michigan's Future approved an 11-bill package. The measures now go to the full state house. But while Governor Snyder supports the current deal, many of his fellow Republicans are balking, especially after the threat of political retribution from the Koch brothers' political network. Michigan Radio's Sarah Swick reports.
Detroit officials have been doing lots of talking in Lansing for the past week, lobbying hard for a state aid package. Kevin Orr, Detroit's state-appointed emergency manager and the bankruptcy lawyer in charge of Detroit's historic case, told lawmakers that the city has a reasonable plan to resolve its issues and avoid a long, complicated court battle. But he says that without state funds, that could easily unravel.
To put it bluntly, we need your money.
This isn't your standard aid package, though. It's a bit more complicated. Together, the state and a group of foundations would come up with over $800 million. Not coincidentally, that's the same value that Christie's Auction House has put on the Detroit Institute of Art's world-class collection. The money would backstop the city's underfunded pensions and spare Detroit retirees the kind of severe cuts Orr had threatened. And then, in theory at least, those retirees would approve Orr's controversial restructuring plan, sparing the museum from a potential fire sale. That deal is dubbed the Grand Bargain, and not surprisingly, it has its critics. Some of Detroit's creditors insist the museum's assets are worth much more than $800 million and argue that the city should be forced to sell at least some pieces to pay them off. And then there are the political critics.
People from outstate, of course, feel that it's not their responsibility. They didn't do it. People from the near suburbs are, you know, irritated and resentful of the fact that they have to bail Detroit out. So there's still a lot of hard feelings.
That's State Senator Mike Kowal, expressing the conventional wisdom about how Michigan's non-Detroiters feel about the city's situation. While Republican Governor Rick Snyder backs the grand bargain, some of his fellow Republicans still see giving Detroit any kind of help to be political poison. And now, the Michigan chapter of an influential conservative group is warning those Republicans that a yes vote will have consequences. Americans for Prosperity is the national political action network backed by industrialist billionaire brothers Charles and David Koch. Scott Hagerstrom directs the group's Michigan chapter and says Michigan has given Detroit too much of its money for decades.
It hasn't worked. It's enabled bad behavior, and it needs to stop.
Hagerstrom argues that Michigan taxpayers shouldn't support the grand bargain when Detroit is sitting on an estimated $3 billion in city assets, including its art museum.
They're in bankruptcy. They need to sell those assets first to provide for their retirees before looking for a handout.
Hagerstrom says Americans for Prosperity will tap its deep pockets and activist network to get Republicans this message. If you vote for the grand bargain, we'll make your life difficult in the next election. But despite that, it's not at all clear that Michigan voters outside Detroit do hate the grand bargain. A poll recently commissioned in part by Michigan Radio found that nearly half those voters support the state helping Detroit. And when they learn that money will go to help city pensioners and protect the museum, support swells to a sizable majority, even among Republican voters. Bernie Porn is with Epic MRA, the firm that conducted the poll.
This is not going to in any way, shape, or form negatively impact legislators running for re-election.
Both the deal's supporters and opponents have little time to pressure lawmakers, though. I'm Sarah Swick in Detroit.
Does a political candidate's weight affect his or her chances of getting elected or even getting on the ballot in the first place? New research by a Michigan State University professor and his wife, a Hope College professor, indicates the answer is, you bet it does. Mark Rowling is a human resources professor at MSU. Mark, what led you and your wife, Patricia, to want to explore this question?
We've both been looking at weight discrimination in the employment context and have been struck over the years about the consistency which it shows up when it's looked for in employment settings. And I'm not sure exactly the discussion that led to it, but we were basically looking to see in what other domains does this weight bias show up. And because of the attention that appearance and other things it receives with political candidates, it occurred to us that one way of testing the generalizability or the extent to which weight bias shows up in many domains of life would be to look at the effect of weight on election outcomes. And I think maybe the whole attention that Chris Christie had been receiving, or Governor Christie, made us think that, well, this is going to be an issue, so let's take a look and see if it's, rather than relying on anecdotes, is there some evidence that backs it up?
If we actually, as we were talking about your study in our office, we kind of did wonder aloud if all the video and photos of Chris Christie, the New Jersey governor, during his Bridgegate scandal and the talk of his White House hopes, if that did get you thinking, because it's very clear Chris Christie's a big man. He's been very open about, he says, over 30 years he struggled with his weight. And really, there are very few politicians that we can think of who carry that much weight. So you looked at getting on the ballot and being elected. What did your research find in terms of actually even getting on the ballot?
To start out with, getting on the ballot, overweight individuals. So we'll distinguish between overweight versus obese, which is basically just a higher level or higher category of having excess weight.
Right.
But both obese and overweight candidates tend to be greatly underrepresented. And in particular, obese candidates seldomly show up. So looking at this 126 elections involving Senate races in two different time periods, there were zero obese women and only 4% of the candidates were obese men, which was one. And in contrast with the general population statistics, we would put it at approximately one-third of the population, male and female roughly, are obese. So there is pretty clear evidence that very few people in the obese range compared to the rate of obesity in the population find their way onto the political ballot for the position of senator.
That's interesting. And when it came to getting on the ballot, you also looked at just merely overweight, so not as full-blown as obese. And you noted that overweight women were very much underrepresented on the ballot, although men were not. So there is a double standard. We'll cut a man more slack when it comes to being overweight than we do a woman?
That's what is certainly consistent with that. That was a clear and strong finding, that being merely overweight affects women and does not affect men. And that is completely consistent with the pattern of findings you get in a number of studies that look at discrimination in the workplace, weight discrimination in the workplace, where women who are merely overweight will experience a wage penalty, and men who are overweight will not only not experience a penalty, in some studies they've actually found they experience somewhat of a premium. In other words, they get a little more than a normal weight individual.
Hmm. This is so interesting, and you just kind of referred to this, that what does this say about us as a nation? Here we are as a nation collectively getting fatter and fatter, but we don't want to see candidates who reflect that?
That's one interpretation, and a fair interpretation. And I think what it really shows is, on one end, there is still are a number of stereotypes that people infer about overweight people, and they include to be things that would not be considered desirable characteristics for a political candidate.
For example,
stereotype would be that overweight people are less conscientious. They don't work hard, pay as much attention to detail. Another stereotype is, despite the if you look at old novels, Dickens novels, A Fat and Jolly, actually when you look at studies of stereotypes, overweight people tend to be viewed as being less agreeable and not jolly. So there are a number of those. Now, one of the things that we really can't isolate completely in terms of the degree of representation on the ballot is the extent to which there is any kind of self-monitoring or self-selection, where either because an overweight person or obese person feels like they won't be received well, they keep themselves out of the process, or because there's some other some way their efficacy or their sense that they'll be successful in some other way is undermined. So we can't tell that exactly, but even that in terms of how many, what percent of that is due to self-selection versus bias and unwilling to elect people to get on the ballot.
Yeah.
But we know once they're on the ballot, weight has a significant effect.
Do you see this bias ever going away? Do you think there is any answer or solution to this?
This question comes up from time to time, and I haven't studied that exactly, but we have noticed in talking to other weight discrimination researchers that among studies that focus among college students, in recent years, there seems to be some evidence that there may be less weight bias among younger people. Mm-hmm. But that's something that's going to have to be done in a more systematic, broad-scale way. But myself and a number of other people have observed that more than we ever used to see, we'll see negative weight findings with college samples, where they don't really, the same type of bias that shows up in field settings and in the past years isn't as consistently showing up. So there could be some differences among young people coming up.
Mark Rowling is a professor of human resources at Michigan State University. His study on weight loss and the electoral process that he co-authored with his wife Patricia Rowling of Hope College was published in the journal Equality, Diversity, and Inclusion. Mark, thanks for talking with us today.
Well, thank you very much for your interest.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. What happens when a house party is going full tilt and the beer runs out? Well, chances are someone goes on a beer run, and chances are that someone has had a few drinks. A new business that's opened in Ann Arbor aims to keep the party going without that someone having to get behind the wheel of a car. Drink Drivers is a new website and mobile app launched by a group of University of Central Florida grads. They've decided to make Ann Arbor their second launch location. We're joined now by Drink Drivers CEO Jeff Nadell. Okay, Jeff, explain how Drink Drivers works.
Absolutely. So customers can download our mobile app or go onto our website on their computer or their cell phone. And with just a few clicks or taps, you can choose from our selection of beer, wine, and liquor at state minimum prices in Michigan and have it delivered right to your doorstep in just a few minutes. No hassle, everything charged straight to your credit card. You don't have to get up off your couch and leave, easy as you can possibly imagine.
And what would a customer pay for the delivery service?
Our delivery fee is only $2.87. And like I said, all liquor is at state minimum prices in Michigan, so it's literally illegal for anyone to charge less for liquor than you can get on Drink Drivers.
And what led you to come up with this whole idea?
Yeah, that's a great question. So we constantly saw people facing this problem of being, on the one hand, forced to choose between being responsible and having a good time, having to, you know, wanting to get in a car and go out and restock with beer and wine and liquor, but realizing that they might not be in the best position to do so. And we wanted to make it so that you could still continue to have a good time and still be responsible. And on the other hand, we realized that it is just a complete hassle to have to leave your house, put a coat on, get in a car, drive to a liquor store, browse the huge inventory, pay, and then drive all the way back. By that time, you've probably missed the fun. You've missed being with your friends. You've missed the game-winning pass on the game that you're watching. There's so much that you miss, and we just wanted to simplify that, make the alcohol come straight to you, and make it a much easier and more fun process as well.
Have you found, I know you launched last year in Orlando, and now you're in Ann Arbor for the second location. Have you found your customers are mainly college age, or are they all ages?
Yeah, we have a really nice kind of combination of customers. We certainly do have some people who are college age. Obviously, everyone is of legal age, but we also have a huge number of customers who are just non-student members of the community, some recent graduates, even some professors and some older members of the community as well, local entrepreneurs and employees at small businesses.
And what led you to look at Ann Arbor? How were you in Orlando and looking around the nation and deciding, boom, Ann Arbor is going to be our second location?
Yeah, Ann Arbor is really an incredible city for a variety of reasons. It's such a rich community, a diverse community with just a lot going on in terms of business, in terms of culture, in terms of education. And more than anything else, we listen to our customers when they speak to us, and we listen to friends of our customers and prospective customers. And we just heard loud and clear from people in Michigan, when it's cold out, we'll do anything to avoid going outside, and this is a service that we want. And we listened. We started engaging in conversations with people in Ann Arbor, and that's what we heard, and so we did it.
The biggest concern would have to be under 21s at a house party, calling drink drivers for an order. So explain to us what you and your drivers do to keep alcohol from getting into the hands of underage customers.
Absolutely. So we use every legal and technological means available to us to ensure that our service is never used by underage individuals to purchase alcohol. And the means, the age verification that someone encounters using drink drivers is at least as thorough, if not even stricter, than that person would encounter going into a liquor store, a bar, a restaurant, so on and so forth. So upon each delivery, the driver checks the ID of the patron, and the drivers are industry veterans who are well-equipped to determine if the ID is fake or real, and then the ID is checked upon each delivery. And in addition to that, when you place an order, we also take your birthday and some identifying information from you, including your driver's license number, so we're able to do back-end checks as well. So we do, again, everything possible to make sure that our service is never used by underage people. And we do, honestly, a whole lot more than a conventional retail environment is able to do.
Would a driver refuse to hand over the product if they weren't comfortable?
Oh, absolutely. And it's happened not too many times because we're very clear about this fact and people understand that our service can't be used for this reason. But a couple of times we certainly have had to do that, and we're more than happy to do it if that's what the circumstances require.
Now, I saw where drink drivers got the endorsement of the Mothers Against Drunk Driving chapter in Central Florida.
So we had there was an article written about us in the Orlando area, and they reached out to Yolanda Larson, the executive director of Mothers Against Drunk Driving Central Florida. And we were very fortunate that she echoed the sentiments that we've expressed, which is that we really believe that drink drivers is the absolute safest way to purchase and enjoy alcohol. And don't get me wrong. If misused, if not treated properly, alcohol can be dangerous. But if you're going to buy it and if you're going to drink it, having it come to you is certainly the safest way to do so. And Ms. Larson expressed similar sentiments in saying that she thinks that, you know, if used properly, drink drivers could lead to reduced drunk driving incidents. And that's, you know, certainly a hope of ours as well.
Jeff, have you had any conversations with either the MAD chapter here or with the Ann Arbor police?
Not yet, but we're actually working to begin those conversations in the coming days, and that's something that's very important to us. Working with community organizations that are committed to you both encouraging responsible consumption of alcohol and discouraging drunk driving and things like that. That's incredibly something that's very close to our hearts, and something we'll certainly do in Ann Arbor as well.
Jeff Nadel, the CEO of Drink Drivers. It's an alcohol delivery service with website and mobile app that has recently opened in Ann Arbor. Jeff, thanks for talking with us.
Thanks so much.
It's called the Detroit Jit, a dance style that began as a street dance in Detroit in the 1970s by a group known as the Jitterbugs. And now the Jit and the Jitterbugs are the subject of a documentary film to be screened this Friday at the Detroit Institute of Arts. Halim Rasool is founder of the dance group Hardcore Detroit and producer of the film The Jitterbugs, Pioneers of the Jit. Halim, welcome to the program.
How you doing?
Good to have you with us. And we're happy to be joined by one of the Jitterbugs. He helped start it all in the 70s. Tracy McGee, good to have you with us.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure talking to you.
Halim, start by describing the Jit to us.
The Jit is basically is intense in footwork. It has shuffles, it has drops, throwback moves, freak moves, and it's the best footwork you're going to see is urban dance coming from Detroit.
And Tracy, this dance has nothing to do with the Jitterbug from the swing era, so we need to get that one off the table right now. If you think you know what the Jitterbug is, take that away, because the Jit is something totally different?
It is. It is. The Jitterbugs came because we were looking for a name. And this old man came walking by and was like, "You young jitterbugs." And we heard and said, "Hey, that's the name we're going to use. We're going to use that name." But it doesn't have anything to do with, you know, the way people danced back in the 20s and the 40s. We were taking the name because the guy said we were like troublemakers.
You decided we own that. Tell us how you came up with the Jit.
That came up because we used to like to go to dance parties, especially at night, and basement parties and stuff like that. And we would go, and people would see us dancing. They would always go really crazy and ask, tell us, let us know that we could really dance. And from that point on, things just progressed even more and more as a dancer. And before we knew it, we did our first gig, and everything went from that point on. Never had a chance to look back.
And I'm curious, and I'm going to ask you both, and I'll start with you, Tracy. Why didn't the JIT get the attention, say, that breakdancing got or Pop and Lock? Why did the JIT kind of stay under the radar screen?
This city has been labeled as a very hard and rough city, and we came from the streets ourselves, and it was a negative. We were doing what we were doing. A lot of people were scared of us back in the day because of the style and the way we were doing it. So now, today, it's a positive. Everything has turned into a positive.
Well, I have to just think of living and working in Detroit in the 70s, and there was a big rise in gang action then. We had the BKs, we had the Coneonis. Did this come out of that gangster scene, Tracy?
Yes, it did come out of that gangster scene, and we were like a part of that gangster scene, but the good thing was that we were not a gang, but we were just there, and we hadn't labeled ourselves, anything like that. We were just being ourselves. And from being around them, they influenced us and we influenced them. But our dance was so popular that we were able to go throughout most neighborhoods and nobody would even bother us. We were there right there with them, but we never considered ourselves a gang. And from being from the street, it changed our lives. And today I feel real fortunate to have the opportunity to speak with someone like you now. And it just, I'm at awe that all of this is happening right now. I'm really at awe. I just cannot believe it.
And here you are, the subject of this documentary, The Jitterbugs, Pioneers of the JIT. Haleem, what made you want to produce this documentary? What really excites you about this story?
Well, like you said, I have a early influence with another dance form called breaking. Or, you know, most people call it break dancing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of a similar story where it comes from the street. And after I got to a certain level with that dance and I traveled and competed and I seen how their dance thrive, made me take a second look, you know, here in Detroit and what we had to offer. And when I started asking questions, you know, nobody really documented it correctly. You know what I'm saying? Everybody knew about this dance and how long he'd been doing it, but there was no facts or nothing really established. So that, you know, basically sparked, you know, my direction.
If I went to Detroit today and I saw kids, could I say, do you dance the JIT? And would they be on it?
Yes, they would.
Yes.
It's crazy going in this city and missing the JIT and somebody not know about it. That's unheard of. That's how popular the dance is.
I'm kind of curious, Tracy, since you were one of the founders of the JIT, you helped originate it with your brothers as a member of the Jitterbugs. How are your dance skills 40 years on?
I love it. I love a challenge. Is that a challenge? Sound like a challenge. Challenge! Anyway, it's my fountain of youth. If you see me today and you'll say to yourself, is he really 53?
Uh-huh.
That's what you would say to yourself. Is he really 53? And then once you saw me dance, you would say, that's amazing. He can still move like that. And I hold all of that to my past because I really had a passion for what we were doing.
Well, this film is going to be screened this Friday, May 23rd at 6 p.m. at the Detroit Institute of Arts. And as well as the screening of the film, there will be a performance by the Jitterbugs, so we hear, along with a special JIT exhibition by contemporary JIT dancers. So you could see the masters, we could see the godfathers and the founders, the guys that made it all happen originally, and then the way it's being done today in 2014. And you can get more information about this at DIA.org. Haleem Rasool and Tracy McGee, it was a lot of fun to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
My pleasure. And once again, once this is all over, we need to see each other just so I can say hi to you.
There you go. Thanks so much, guys.
The winners and new champions of Dancing with the Stars are Meryl and Matt.
West Bloomfield's Meryl Davis has a new prize to go along with her Olympic gold medal. The ice dancer and her partner Maxim Chmerkovsky took home the Mirrorball trophy last night on Dancing with the Stars. Meryl had been competing on season 18 against her ice dancing partner Charlie White of Bloomfield Hills. He was eliminated last week. You may recall Charlie and Meryl were with us on Stateside prior to winning every top honor possible in the world of ice dancing, including that Olympic gold. The two, of course, are students at the University of Michigan. It was 1934. The nation was deep in the Great Depression. FDR was in the White House. William Comstock was Michigan's 33rd governor. And a University of Michigan graduate student in botany found an agave plant while he was on a botanical expedition to Mexico. He brought it back to Ann Arbor. Now, 80 years later, that agave plant is getting set to bloom for its first and its only time. Michael Palmer is the horticultural manager at the Mathai Botanical Gardens and Nichols Arboretum. Michael, is it typical for an American agave to take 80 years to kick out a bloom?
It's unusual. It usually takes 10 to 30 years. We don't exactly know why our plant took 80 years to put up the flower stalk, but that's what it did.
And what does it look like today?
Well, before it flowered, sent up the flower stalk, it was 6 feet tall and about 8 feet wide. It looks like a sort of like an octopus with variegated yellow and green leaves that have a very sharp spine on the end and saw-like teeth along the edges of the leaves. And now in the middle is shooting up the flower stalk, which is 18 feet tall.
Wow. What will it look like when it blooms?
Well, this is the original stalk, which is by itself, just a shoot like a giant asparagus, and it will make side branches, and on those side branches will be yellow-green flowers.
And how long would the blooms last?
Well, the whole flowering process will probably be months. A single bloom, I'm not exactly sure, probably a day or two, but there'll be hundreds of flowers.
There'll be hundreds of flowers. And after this agave plant blooms, it dies?
Yes, it's a monocarpic species, which means it sets seeds and dies. What happens is the plant knows it's done what it's supposed to do, procreate the species, and it starts shutting down. My wife made a comment to me, I believe that the thing is dying because you can't imagine how much energy that would take to send up an 18-foot flower stalk.
I guess so. So it is absolutely no exaggeration to say that this is truly the swan song of this 80-year-old plant.
Yes, it certainly is.
But you are going to be able to carry on its legacy through its pups? Explain that to us.
So most people are familiar with that plants set seeds, and then you plant the seeds and you grow the same plant pretty much. But many of the desert species do this thing where they make little plantlets on the flower stalk. So it has nothing to do with the flower itself. No pollination happens, but it makes these tiny miniature plants that when they fall off the stalk, they hit the ground and they root and grow.
Hmm.
So they're clones, basically, of that plant.
For people who want to come see this plant and see it bloom, what timetable would you suggest?
Well, the flowers, I believe, this is just a guess, will open in about a month because we haven't even started the side branching on the stalk yet. And we're also planning so the stalk is about 3 feet from the glass ceiling, and when it reaches that, we will take a piece of glass off of the roof, and hopefully it will go up above that, but we're still waiting to see what happens with that. And it should bloom for a long period of time. They don't all open at once, so it'll be in succession, so it'll bloom for months, so people will have an opportunity.
It's a good year to plan to come visit that agave plant.
Yes, it is.
Michael Palmer is the horticulture manager for the Mathai Botanical Gardens and the Nichols Arboretum in Ann Arbor, talking to us about the rare 80-year-old agave preparing to bloom for the very first time. Michael, thanks so much for talking with us.
You're welcome.
Picture this. You live in a corner of the Upper Peninsula that's full of natural beauty. But the population in your town is shrinking and it's aging, even to the point where it's tough to find police officers and firefighters because everyone's just getting older. And there's little in the way of economic opportunity. And now here comes a huge Canadian company who wants to buy 10,000 acres of state-managed forest land and build a massive limestone mining operation. There's the prospect of a lot of money and the hope of jobs. And there's the fear of losing the natural beauty of your corner of the UP. What to do? That's the real-life dilemma happening right now in the Rexton area of the Upper Peninsula. Keith Matheny is a writer with the Detroit Free Press, and he's been following this story. Keith, tell us, where is the area we're talking about?
Well, it's in Mackinac County. It's actually surrounded by Hendricks and Hudson townships in Mackinac County, maybe 15 minutes north of US 2, the big freeway that runs through the UP.
So what does this company, Graymont, want to do with the 10,000 acres it's proposing to buy?
Well, that would be part of a really massive 13,000-acre mining operation that would include open pit mining. And eventually, decades down the road, when the open pits are exhausted, they would like to use the bulk of the property for an underground mining site. And one of the things they're telling the DNR is because we'll be underground, with the exception of a few facilities that we'll need, the surface activities, hunting, you know, off-road vehicle use, whatever may be going on in that area, could still continue, and the surface area could still be under DNR management. Others are more skeptical of, you know, what that may mean for them.
Well, how do those promises about minimizing the environmental impact, how do those square with Greystone's mining operations, not only elsewhere in the U.S., we know they also have a limestone mine at Port Inland, about 45 miles west of Rexton.
Correct. They're, I believe, the second largest limestone operation in North America. They have a number of different sites in the U.S. They have a big limestone concern down in Mexico, and the one you mentioned that already exists in the UP. We were able to find, they were fined $200,000 by the state of Wisconsin in 2012 for air pollution violations related to their operation in Superior, Wisconsin, on the western shore of Lake Superior. And they had a smaller fine from the government of Pennsylvania for an operation they have there. Did not see any violations related to the Gulliver facility in the UP.
What are they offering? What could be the payoff for that area of the Upper Peninsula if the DNR agrees to sell the 10,000 acres?
Well, what it would mean for the state is probably tens of millions of dollars of revenue that would be used probably within, you know, forestry management or some sort of a recreational fund through the DNR. Obviously, the tax base would change. It would go from open forest land, you know, to a factory, and that would mean, you know, filling the township coffers with quite a bit more tax revenue as well. The deal is still being negotiated, and I know because there would be so much more truck traffic related to a limestone facility, the township officials up there really want some assurances that the roads would be taken care of by Graymont as well.
Did I read your story correctly that Graymont's proposing only six jobs at the mine?
Six jobs. All of this is for six mining jobs. Now, there's a thought that there would be sort of a ripple effect from it, and that those jobs would lead to other jobs. But even at that, they're talking maybe years down the road of including a limestone processing plant at the mining site. But even with that, they're talking maybe two dozen jobs. And that sounds like a pittance, and maybe it is, but you've got to look at it in the context of the Rexton area, which literally has a gas station party store as its business district. It has one blinking traffic light, and most of the residents there are retirees. So if you're a young person who is looking to stay in the area, it's really difficult to find work.
What do you hear from people in the Rexton area?
When you talk to the retirees, they came there for a quality of life that is related to all of the forest land, the lakes, the magnificent snowmobile and ORV trails, and they definitely see this as something that will take away from that. in a permanent sort of way, and they're vehemently opposed. If you talk to other folks, they, you know, like the hope that it brings in terms of the economics. As you mentioned, these areas are getting older. They're having trouble getting first responders and firefighters. People who are of a working age often have to travel maybe an hour one way in terms of a commute to try to find a job. So they're looking at the local economic opportunity. When you talk to the township officials up there, they seem to think that most people are leaning toward supporting it, but have real significant concerns about how it might impact, you know, their water wells, you know, the hydrology in general, and what would be required of Graymont in terms of fixing areas that they tear up with their mining operation.
And it is DNR managed forest land, so it's up to them to make the decision. But what process is the DNR using as it goes about the fact finding and decision making?
Well, one of the things that I think a lot of people find interesting is ultimately this will be a decision of the DNR director, Keith Cree. It will probably be made at a Natural Resources Commission meeting, but it is not a Natural Resources Commission decision. So it's somewhat interesting that something this significant that will absolutely transform life for generations in the UP more or less comes down to one guy. And there's not a lot of layers of accountability in terms of, you know, if it was a legislative decision. The DNR is undertaking a lot of different reviews of this process. They've commissioned some scientific studies to look at things like the groundwater impacts. They've had you know, public hearings and meetings up there with tribal leaders, with community members. So there's kind of a lot of different processes going on. I was told there's not really any sort of timetable for a decision, but they want to move carefully because they recognize it's a pretty big deal.
The state DNR is now seeking public comments on the proposed sale. You can go to Michigan.gov and search for Graymont, G-R-A-Y-M-O-N-T, and that will give you links to information not only about the proposal, but a link for you to submit your comments. Now we turn to an environmental story that we've been following closely here on Stateside, and you've got a piece in today's Free Press about it, Keith, and that's the proposal by a Canadian utility to build underground storage for low and intermediate level nuclear waste and do it in the Ontario town of Kincardine, just a quarter mile from the shores of Lake Huron. Now we're seeing some Michigan lawmakers kicking into action. Who's taking action and what are they doing?
Well, State Senator Phil Pavlov, who's a Republican in St. Clair Township, and a few other mostly Thumb area lawmakers are introducing a package of legislation that would include bills and some resolutions that really are taking a multi-pronged approach to trying to stop this nuclear waste site near the shores of Lake Huron. It would include strengthening Michigan's prohibitions against importing nuclear waste to include some of the more dangerous levels of low-level nuclear waste. We already have a ban. They want to kind of expand it to include more radioactive waste. And with regards to the Kincardine facility, they're passing or they're seeking to pass a resolution that would urge President Obama, Secretary of State John Kerry, and the Congress to become more active on this. What they would like is the something called the International Joint Commission. That's a dual Canada-U.S. agency that was created by treaty a long time ago to resolve Great Lakes-related disputes. They want to get them engaged on this because they really see Pavlov told me yesterday that he really sees this as something that the whole Great Lakes Basin should be concerned about. And some of the bills that they're talking about would create a panel that would sort of hold hearings on the Michigan side looking at the potential impacts of this. And I'm told it's about raising awareness, kind of raising the warning flag and getting more people engaged.
So it seems that it's largely symbolic just because the decision is ultimately going to be made by the Canadian government, yes?
That's true. You know, there are pieces that would strengthen what Michigan's doing. But, yeah, one of the recurring themes with this Kincardine proposal is that you've got an agency of the Canadian government making a decision that impacts the drinking water supply of something like 25 million Americans, you know, who get their water from the Great Lakes. So it's an interesting conundrum, and it will be quite something to see whether this sort of pressure that they're getting from the American side influences the Canadian decision.
And in fact, as you note in your piece in the Free Press, that Senator Phil Pavlov has unveiled an online petition site so Michiganders can speak out and air their views about the Kincardine Underground Storage Facility. It's protectlakehuron.com. That's protectlakehuron.com. Keith, do we know when the Canadian government's expected to make its decision on the proposal from Ontario Power Generation?
Well, there was a timetable that seemed to indicate it would be coming, by about the middle of this year, but that may have been slowed down by some revelations this spring. A former scientist with Ontario Power Generation, the utility there that wants to build the Kincardine facility, discovered that some of the materials that would be stored there were much more radioactive than was told to the people considering the site. So that has kind of thrown a wrench into things, and they're doing some reevaluation. As well, in February in New Mexico, a underground nuclear waste storage facility had an accident that led to the exposure to radiation of some workers at the surface. And it's a similar facility to what's proposed in Kincardine, and that kind of sort of sent shockwaves through the process here as well. And I think there's sort of a new round of evaluation going on. I would still believe that the Canadian government will make a decision yet this year, but there may be some delays.
Keith Matheny of the Detroit Free Press, always good talking with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Cynthia.
Here's the challenge. Get yourself from New Orleans to Detroit in 36 hours, no cash, no credit cards, just your charm and ingenuity. Oh, and one other thing. You'll be dressed up as your favorite hero. It's the Escape for Good charity race. And if making your way from New Orleans to Detroit wearing your Batman suit or your Forrest Gump beard, trucker hat, and sneakers sounds like your thing, you can sign on now for the race that starts Friday. Rocco Gardner is the creator of Escape for Good. Welcome.
Great to be here. Thank you.
So it's the third year you've done Escape for Good. Where did this idea even begin?
Well, we originated with producing festivals in the States. So we had one in New York on the Shinnecock Reservation, which was a lot of fun. And we brought some, some good funds to the tribe and training. Had about 5,000 people. But afterwards, I kind of was left thinking, well, I'd like to do something that brings more good and allows people to leave with more than a hangover. so that's kind of how it started out.
So tell us how it works, because what I think, no cash, no credit cards, and the costumes, how does that all fit?
That's right. Well, we basically all meet at a chosen location, which this time is New Orleans, and we have a little party the night before, and then the next morning we all go off the start line at the same time. We take away your money and your credit cards. We put them in a little Ziploc pouch, which you carry with you just in case there's an emergency. And then we all hug each other and kiss each other and say goodbye, and off we go. Previously we had a 24-hour period to get as far as you possibly could. This time we're actually going to do an A to B race, so we're doing New Orleans to Detroit. That's it in a nutshell, really.
But the costume, now, come on. And you've done this, right? Didn't you?
yeah,
did you wear
right.
a big no, bunny cause... suit, did I hear?
Yeah, that's right. So the first time we did it from New York, from Milk Studios. And I partnered up with my right-hand man, Buck, dressed as giant bunny rabbits, as Rocco Balboa, so Rocky Balboa, and he was the Incredible Hulk. And we managed to get down to South Beach, so some kind people got us a flight to Washington, D.C., and then we were driven around there by a great family, visited all the sites, and then went through Virginia and then got to South Beach, and it was amazing.
So people are hitchhiking, they're schmoozing, they're
everything
and anything.
Everything. I'm sorry, that's our mascot in the background there. But we were hitchhiking, using skateboards, using buses, aeroplanes, anything we could. And I was actually amazed by how wonderful the American people are and how friendly they are. And people just saying, hey, what are you doing? How can I help? How can I get involved?
And how does this raise money for charity?
Well, we use CrowdRise, which is a charity platform. So people raise money before the race. Each team selects their own 501c charity, And they go out to their friends and family and people they meet, and they say, hey, we'd love you to back us. And then actually on the race day, people that they're meeting along the way as well can give donations. And then we also have a bonus prize. So along the way, there are challenges and things that you can document with your camera and upload to the internet. And the more of these challenges you succeed in doing, the more miles you win, escape miles. And the team with the most miles will win a bonus prize, which has been very generously donated by the Seminole Tribe of Florida, which is $20,000 to the first team's charity and $5,000 to the second team's charity.
So you're doing good as you're having quite the experience, but I still have to wonder, like, what is it about wearing the Superman suit that makes this part of the Escape for Good charity race?
Yeah, well, I did that the second time. You don't have to be a superhero. It's just your hero. But somehow dressing up and being in costume gets people engaged and gets people interested. It obviously makes for great photographs as well. So, you know, our aim is really to blow this up on the internet mainly. And we had roughly 1 million people tuning in last time, which was fun. So you can follow the race via Escape at Escape, which is on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook.com/Escape. We just try and get as many people involved as possible and have as much fun as we can whilst doing something good.
And what lessons do you think you and other racers have learned from the previous Escape for Good charity races?
I think really it's just really engaging with your cause that you choose to get involved with. So people obviously spend a lot of time with their charities, talking to them, and I think you just take a lot away from it. You know, it's fun seeing your friends on a holiday weekend, or it's fun, you know, going to a party or a festival. But really with this one, you give up a short amount of your own time, have a lot of fun, and you do a lot of good.
The website is www.esca.pe for all the details on the race and links to sign up. And be forewarned then, if you're driving south of Detroit the weekend of May 23rd, do not be surprised if you see Superman or a great big bunny making his way into Motown. Rocco Gardner from Escape Productions, thanks so much and good luck.
Thank you very much.
Today's Stateside was produced and directed by Ellie Billings. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer today was Bob Scon. Contributors are Emily Fox, Chris Hattelsey, Mercedes Mejia, Omar Sade, Katie Suha, and Jeff Warniak. This program's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening, and join us again tomorrow.